Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We extend to you a very warm welcome to be with us, where we plan to present a public lecture to the title Israel, Russia and Christ's Coming. It's a very challenging subject, particularly in light of the current events which are happening in the world at this time. Our speaker for this evening, Mr. Dan Jolly, to preface his remarks, he has asked that we read from the Old Testament book of Daniel, chapter 2, commencing at verse 31 through to the end. Well, that reading serves to introduce the remarks of our speaker this evening, Mr. Dan Jolly, who will speak to the title, Israel, Russia, and Christ's Coming.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for having me back again. It's really nice to be here and to have the opportunity to talk to you about exciting things out of God's Word. Tonight, we're going to speak about Daniel's image primarily, but yes, we are going to get to Israel and Russia and Christ coming right at the very end. And of course, it's all wrapped up together. As we will see by and by. I wanted to start by a passage from Elpis Israel. I would imagine this is a passage that we're all reasonably familiar with. It comes from the introduction to Elpis Israel. It's now 150 years old. And 150 years ago, a Christadelphian was writing that the Russian autocracy would, right on the brink of their collapse, be represented by the image of Nebuchadnezzar that we've just read about in Daniel chapter 2. And that's what we want to look at tonight. We want to look at how Daniel chapter 2 explains for us the world in which we live. And we want to take a little bit of a deeper dive into what we often call Daniel's image. And it wasn't really Daniel's image, was it? It was Nebuchadnezzar's. It was Nebuchadnezzar who had this dream, this vision, and it was Daniel who was the interpreter who God had given wisdom to that he might explain the contents of this terrifying dream that so bothered the emperor, the king of kings, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. And so tonight we're going to take a little bit of a deep dive into Daniel 2, and hopefully, for all of us, we have some foundation, some understanding of Daniel chapter 2. If you don't, my humble apologies, tonight's going to be a bit of a blur, and let's talk about it over supper. We can perhaps fill in some of the gaps. But hopefully for the rest of us, we'll all walk away with something that we've seen afresh or something that we've learned new from Daniel chapter 2 this evening. So, a quick refresher on Daniel chapter 2. You'll recall a head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar saw this terrifying image standing with a head of gold, and he was told, point blank, this head of gold represents you and your kingdom, Nebuchadnezzar. You are the head of gold. And this was to be followed by an inferior kingdom described as, well, breast and arms of silver, which represented the two sides of the Medo-Persian or the Achaemenid Empire, which would follow or succeed the Babylonians. And this was followed by the Greeks, led by Alexander the Great, which would then break into four different kingdoms, finally settling down into two major empires, if you like, within the Greek dominion, and then the Romans. The Romans would arrive just before the turn of the millennium and conquer all that had been the Greek Empire and be this vast and powerful kingdom that would straddle the then known world. And the Babylonian kingdom was going to last for a very long time. We'll talk about this in a little bit more detail in a few moments. And some of you may look at that chart and go, hold it. I'm not so sure about that. I thought the Roman Empire finished in about 400 AD. I think I said the Babylonians there. I meant the Romans finished about 400 AD. And we've got them on the chart here running through to 1800 AD. We'll explain this by and by. And then Daniel's image or Nebuchadnezzar's image and Daniel's explanation runs through and describes a progression, if you like, of that fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire, and describes it as, well, a kingdom divided. It describes it as a kingdom of iron. That was the element that was used to represent the Romans, but mixed or alloyed with clay. And this would be a new phase of that fourth kingdom that would last into the future, even beyond our day, we believe. And so that interpretation of these elements of this statue, the gold, the silver, the brass, the iron, representing Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, it's nothing new. Many of us will have learnt this in Sunday school, and it's not even new to Christadelphians or new to Christian believers. This is a very, very old understanding. Hippolytus wrote, presumably before 235, in his treatise on Christ and the Antichrist, that the golden head represented the Babylonians, the silver represented the Persians, the belly and thighs, and so on and so on and so on. Hippolytus was saying this in 235 AD. The book of 2nd Esdras, we don't quite know who wrote that, but as early as 218 AD, pardon me, I'm saying a lot of wrong words tonight, he talks about the eagle, the symbol of the eagle coming up and being an apt representation of the fourth kingdom of Daniel's image. And he lived in the Roman era and used that as a symbol of the Romans. Irenaeus, described as a church father, what he believed we're not quite sure, but he writes that concerning the 10 kings who shall arise, among whom the empire which now rules shall be petitioned, Daniel says that the fourth kingdom consists in the toes of the image seen by Nebuchadnezzar. And again, whoever wrote, Irenaeus lived in the Roman era. And so this is not new information. What's wonderful about this interpretation is how detailed such a simple image is. And I find this really exciting. We look at this as, I guess, Sunday school material, and yet there's a lot of detail in Daniel 2 lurking beneath the surface. Okay, the Babylonians are the head of gold. That one's pretty straightforward. But as soon as we come on to the Persians, there's two arms. Two arms. And when you look and dig into the detail of that silver kingdom, well, we describe it as a Medo-Persian kingdom. And yet, people debate this. They've decided that, no, it wasn't a Medo-Persian kingdom, it was just a Persian kingdom. And yet, when you go back into the histories, you find strong support for this being a two-armed kingdom. The image on the screen there is from a relief in Iran, modern-day Iran. It was put up by, I think, Darius, and it's called the Behustun inscription. And in it, he refers to his army and his kingdom. And again, he describes them as the people of Persia and Media, the Persian and the Median army. He talks about his kingdom as being a two-armed kingdom with Persia on one side and the Media on the other. And so while you may hear from some people, oh, no, it was the single Achaemenid Empire. It was a united empire. And yes, it was united. Those who lived in it saw very clearly that there were two arms to the Medo-Persian Empire. We might think, well, that's obvious. We knew that. But people debate this, and it's important for us to understand that the scripture holds accurate detail. We move on to the thighs, the belly and thighs of brass. And while the Greek kingdom did start as a single united kingdom under the headship of Alexander the Great, that was not to last long, and it split into, well, multiple kingdoms, but in the end, just two, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, the only kingdoms of significance after the famed wars of the Diadochi were complete. Two legs. The Romans were always split in one way or another, that were led by two consuls at any given time. The Caesar himself, at least on paper, was expected to answer to two individuals, the consuls of Rome, who were the highest elected officials in the empire, who in theory, even after the emergence of the Caesars and the establishment of the empire, held the highest public office. The government of Rome saw itself as sitting on two legs. You may have seen that famous symbol, the SPQR of the Roman flag. And that's short for a term that they used. It was, they had this term, the Senatus Populus Q Romanus. I've probably pronounced that appallingly, but SPQR. And it was short. It was an acronym for the Senate and the People of Rome. The Senate and the People of Rome, the two legs upon which the Republic stood. And eventually, as we know, the Roman Empire was indeed to split into two halves. In the reign of Diocletian in AD 285, the two halves of the empire were formally divided. There were then two emperors, one in the east, one in the west, an eastern and western leg. Both initially governed from Rome, but eventually even that too split as they became governed from Rome in the west and Constantinople in the east, in Nova Roma, New Rome, the city of Constantine. So this is stuff we know. And when we look at these materials, it's obvious to anyone who looks at the raw materials revealed in this dream that the value drops as we go through this dream. Gold was indeed a feature of Babylon. Its enormous wealth was flaunted in its use of gold on buildings and on idols all throughout the city of Babylon. We know that silver was the currency of Persia and that they established an elaborate division of the empire to ensure that silver taxes could be collected and remitted back to the emperor. The Greeks were famous for their innovative use of brass in warfare. They weren't by any stretch the first to use brass, but no one was so skillful in the artificing of weapons using brass as the Greeks. They had technology that no one else had at that time. And so they became known as the brazen-coated Greeks. And as for iron, well, iron had been a symbol of Rome even before Romulus and Remus, the legendary founders of Rome, were born. Deuteronomy, long before Rome even started. And Moses said, prophesying of a day in Israel's distant future, he said that because of Israel's sin, a time would come when they would put a yoke of iron upon your neck. And the nation that would do so, they would come from the ends of the earth, they would speak a tongue that the Jewish people would not understand, the Latin tongue we now know, and they would fly as swift as the eagle flies. So here in this ancient prophecy of Moses's, we have two symbols brought together. The iron of Rome, who would oppress the Jewish people in time. And interestingly, and I want you to notice this, the eagle. So the value diminished of the various different metals. And it's not just that the value of these metals diminished. Each is less dense as well. It's less dense, it's less valuable. And when you think about it, that's kind of backwards. You see, while the materials decline in value and in density, the empires represented by these materials certainly did not decline. Here's the density of the different materials. You can see gold, 19.3 grams per cubic centimetre, and clay, 1.8 gram per cubic centimetre. They certainly decline. The values here, 123,000 Australian dollars per kilo for gold, and clay you can pretty much get for free in your backyard. The value of these metals and the density of them diminish as we go through them, and yet That cannot be said for the empires themselves. The Babylonian Empire only lasted 73 years in the end. The Persians, 209, a bit better. The Greeks, 267. But the Romans, a much, much longer duration and span of their empire. And so it makes you think, doesn't it? Like, it feels like Daniel's interpretation here is a bit backwards, isn't it? This image is sort of reversed. The materials decline in value and density, but the empires they represent don't seem to be declining. So what's going on with this representation? Here's just because it's worth showing you, the sizes. So you can see it on a map. So the Babylonian Empire. Here's the Persian Empire. Here's the four Greek empires once they're broken up. Slightly bigger in size than the previous Persian Empire. But then we come to the Roman Empire, and it's almost three times the size in the end of the other empires combined. So what's going on? Why is the Roman Empire of less value than the Babylonian Empire in this vision? What is the meaning of this? Well, as with everything in this particular vision, Daniel explains it to Nebuchadnezzar. And we actually have an explanation elsewhere inside Daniel as well. But here in Daniel 2, Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, "Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, glory. Wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, the fowls of the heaven, has he given into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold." Now, there's a connection of thought between those two sentences. He's saying, look, you've got absolute power in the world which you rule. Whatever you want to do, even the beasts of the field and the birds of the air must be subject to you. Things which have no ruler, no master, they are ruled by you, O king. You're a head of gold. Or as would be said later on in Daniel chapter 5, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father is speaking to Belshazzar here, and majesty, gave him a kingdom, majesty, glory, honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, languages, tongues trembled, feared before him. Whom he would he slew, whom he would he kept alive, whom he would he set up, whom he would he put down. And the point of this is that the difference between these metals is not the size, it's not the duration, it's about the quality of the rulership within that kingdom. It's about the power vested in the king. Nebuchadnezzar was gold because, well, he was an absolute autocrat, a god among men whom no one could question. And if he said, that man dies, it doesn't matter who that man was, they died. And nobody could question his authority on any matter whatsoever. Except, of course, as we discovered, the Most High God. He was gold. The Persian kingdom was inferior, though, because, well, the king was not quite so... Oh, yes, he could kill who he would. But you see, he was bound by the law, bound by his own laws, limited by the laws of the Medes and Persians. And by the time we come to the brass kingdom, well, the kingdom of Alexander the Great, the power of the Greek monarchs, the various Seleucid and Ptolemaic emperors, they were continuously hampered over the next 250 years by their endless wars and their eternal bickering. None of them were particularly powerful or able to pursue the mandate that they really wanted to pursue because, well, there was no unity within their kingdom. And by the time we come to the Iron Kingdom, the Roman empires, they might have liked to present themselves as Caesars and as gods among men, but they were not. They were severely limited. They were appointed by the Senate. They were subject to the Senate and the populace, and in theory at least were ruled by the two consuls. In practice, even though many tried to emulate Nebuchadnezzar's greatness, most of them failed, being brought low either by the Senate or the Praetorian Guard. And so hopefully what you can see in that when God selected the materials for this vision, he did so very carefully to demonstrate a very particular point about the power of the kings and of the rulers of the various empires. And we can see a decline of the empires as represented by the metals. It speaks of their power. It speaks of the value of their decisions within the state that they ruled. And so when we come to the feet, I've got to ask the question, why is the last material clay? Why not continue with the metal theme and use maybe a soft junk metal like lead? I mean, that would have worked, wouldn't it? Lower value, lower density, it would have been fine. Why use clay for this kingdom divided? If the value of the material represents the importance, the value placed upon the ruler within their kingdom, their ability to command and to implement their will in their kingdom, what does clay speak of? And if the hardness of the material speaks of the strength, the might of the empire, how do we interpret the clay? And by the way, not just the clay. Because you see, in each instance that this word clay is used in Daniel 2, except for just one use, it speaks not of normal clay as fired clay, but in fact of wet clay. It speaks of clay not yet hardened, not yet fired. In other words, the rulers represented by the clay here, mostly in this chapter, apart from the one exception I'll show you in a little while, are valueless. They can't bind anything together. They have no strength of their own at all. They are unable to hold together any parts of this divided kingdom in the feet, part of iron, part of clay. In fact, the binding force must be the iron. Nothing else can hold this fracturing kingdom together because the clay is soft and wet and weak. The clay is just there, tied in by the metal. It's initially at least malleable and weak. So, what are we to make of these things? What are we looking at? Maybe everything we've said so far, you're thinking, well, yes, I knew all of that. That was pretty straightforward. Thank you for the revision. Time for supper. But hopefully, some of you saw something new in what we looked at there. But I find this chapter extremely motivating, extremely exciting, because you see, if you look back down to the previous page, Daniel chapter 2 and verse 28, there's a phrase there that if you don't have it underlined in your Bible, you really should. And young people, if you've got a pencil and this is not underlined, underline it now. Because it says there in verse 28, as Daniel begins the explanation to Nebuchadnezzar, he says, "There is a God in heaven that reveals secrets, that makes known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days." Underline that phrase, "in the latter days," because you see, that's really important as we try to understand Daniel 2. Other versions say, "in the times to come." Young's literal, "in the latter end of days." And when we look at that phrase, "the latter days," it's a very significant phrase. Later on in Daniel chapter 10, Daniel will say this, Gabriel will say to Daniel, "Now I am come to make thee understand what will befall thy people in the latter days, for the vision is yet for many days." This language is used of things in the distant future from Daniel's time. And when we look up this phrase, the latter days, and we're not even going to try and go through all these passages, but here are all the passages that refer to the latter days using the same language as Daniel is using here. And if we look at these passages on the screen, many of them, we don't even need to think about them. We know that these are passages that refer to the kingdom age. Isaiah 2 verse 2, the mountain of God's house would be established in the mountaintops. When does that happen? It's in the kingdom, isn't it? Or Ezekiel 38 verse 16, when Gog comes to cover Israel's land like a cloud in the latter days. When is that? We know when these passages fall. So they're the easy ones. They're all kingdom age passages highlighted in blue now. If we look at the rest of them and spend a little bit more time on them, we'll be able to see when we read the context, when we read the rest of the chapter around them, that these two are passages that describe a time yet future, events that have still not, even in our day, transpired. When you look at that, there's really only one passage among those where there's any question about whether the use of the latter days refers to something future to Daniel's time or future to ours. Every single one of those, apart from Jeremiah 48, 47, is future to our day. And I'd argue that even Jeremiah 48, 47 is. I just can't prove it from the context. So when Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, this is a vision of the latter days, he's saying to Nebuchadnezzar, this is something that refers to the distant future. And what was it that Nebuchadnezzar saw? Well, something roughly like this. Now, of course, it wasn't exactly like that. That's the best I could get out of AI at this stage. And I cannot tell you how many different times I had to tell the AI what I wanted before it came up with anything remotely like this. When I showed this particular series of slides to a group of young men earlier in the year, I was left with the head of the image being an Egyptian head, and I couldn't change it. No matter what I told it, it kept on giving back the head of Pharaoh. We've got it a little bit better now. But what Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream was that. And I need to labor this point a little bit. You see, in this dream in which Daniel informs Nebuchadnezzar that he is seeing something that concerns the end of days, the latter times, he sees one statue standing. Here's what he didn't see, young people. He didn't see just the head of gold on its own, reigning for 73 years before being replaced by the Persians, who reigned on their own without the Babylonians until the arrival of the Greeks, and they were completely overcome by the Greeks, and then there were just the Greeks. And then the legs of iron, at which point there wasn't a Greek empire anymore, was there? And into our day, the feet. That's not what Nebuchadnezzar saw. What Nebuchadnezzar saw was that, all of it standing together. All of the empires now united in one fearsome image, the image of a man astride the empires of the world, all of them standing defiantly at one time. And that's not something that's happened yet, young people. History, as it played out, showed us one empire at a time. The old was conquered, consumed by the new. But this dream was at a point in time where some uniting power would reanimate all these dead empires and cause them to stand together. Now, all this is not to say that Daniel 2 should not be viewed as a guide to history. It's right that we understand that Daniel 2 holds for us a prophetic continuum of the empires. In fact, Daniel's explanation demands this perspective. Verse 34, thou sawest till a stone. You see, it's about a period of time. When Daniel explains it to Nebuchadnezzar, he's saying, look, there's a history, there's a till, there's a time here. Or verse 39, he says, after you. There is a sort of continuum being described. In verse 40, he's going to say there's a fourth kingdom. There's a history, an ordinality to this. And so, yes, Daniel's interpretation described history. But that's Daniel's interpretation. It's not what Nebuchadnezzar saw. What Nebuchadnezzar saw was the situation at the end, in the latter days, in the months and the years before the stone struck. And there's something else here I want us to just think about, and maybe you haven't thought about this before. See, what I've done here is I've put up a graph of the Hebrew words, and I've gone through and I've counted all the Hebrew words that are used in this section to describe the various different elements. And between verse 38 and 45, Daniel gives Nebuchadnezzar the interpretation, the meaning of his dream. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar would have been most interested in the parts of the dream that related to him. And yet, the fewest words possible are used of the gold empire. In fact, when we look at which of the kingdoms the Spirit provides the most information, it is, unsurprising to us, the last one. In fact, that becomes even more stark when we stack up all the words that are used to describe all the other kingdoms versus that divided kingdom, the fourth kingdom and what comes from it, that broken kingdom of iron and of clay. More words are dedicated to providing detail concerning that kingdom than all the rest. Because that's what God, and consequently Daniel, and you and me, should be most interested in. Because, well, that part of the image is the bit that relates to our world. The world in which we exist just before the stone strikes. And so, 2 points so far. Daniel's interpretation gives us a historical timeline, but Nebuchadnezzar's vision showed our future at a point in time. That's the first point. And the second point is the level of detail in the interpretation provided by Daniel informs us that the portion of that timeline that God is most interested in is the final broken empire of iron and of clay. Okay, so let's have a look at that final broken empire in a little bit more detail. Firstly, if we were to take Daniel's prophetic chapters and put them on a little bit of a timeline, what we'll see is that about 50 years later, Daniel too starts receiving dreams of his own. And his dreams, 50 years later, relate to the same subject material. The material that the Spirit gave to Daniel is focusing in and focusing his attention and our attention on the same period of history. And we know these again reasonably well. Daniel 7, Daniel's first dream, he has this dream of the four beasts of the sea. And in many ways, this would have been a refresher of the detail that Daniel had been the interpreter for 50 years earlier. It addressed the same chronology of empires. First of all, there was the Babylonian, and then there was the Medo-Persian, and then there was the Greek, and then finally, and I'm using a controversial image here, I know, there were the Romans. The perspective Daniel has is different, of course, because unlike Nebuchadnezzar, neither Daniel nor Daniel's God saw anything remotely attractive in the kingdoms of men. When they looked at them, they didn't see some glorious statue carved in wonderful metals. No, what they saw was something altogether different. They depicted these kingdoms as vile, mutant beasts staggering up out of turbulent seas. But once again, the eye of the Spirit in Daniel 7 focused upon the fourth kingdom, the one that would be divided, and developments late in its history. There's a few things that kind of pop out when we read that section. You see, it was made very clear to Daniel that the fourth beast that he witnessed was just a different perspective on the fourth kingdom Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed. The fourth beast would be strong. The only other use of that word is for the iron kingdom in Daniel 2. The fourth beast was the fourth beast, and the fourth kingdom was the fourth kingdom. There's a sort of ordinal connection there. And both of these kingdoms would break in pieces their enemies. Daniel would have known that these two pictures related to the same material. And when Daniel looked at the fourth beast, he would have seen some details that are emphasized. Of course, Daniel would have been horrified by the little horn that spoke great things. We know that was a brilliant representation of that enduring part of the Roman Empire that was animated by the apostate church and that would flourish into the Holy Roman Empire. But there was something else that stood out to Daniel as well, if you forgive the pun there. This beast did more than devour like the bear or dominate like the leopard. No, it stamped with its feet. It trampled its enemies down. And it would have been hard for Daniel to miss the point that this fourth beast represented the same thing as the legs and feet of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And so Daniel had this amazing vision. The fourth beast represented the western leg in the end and feet of the Roman Empire. And our Lord later on would give additional detail in Revelation 12 and 13 and 16. This vision in Daniel 7 is given in Aramaic. It's not Daniel's native language of Hebrew. It's the Chaldean language, and that serves to emphasize that this kingdom would indeed be one that was foreign to Daniel and foreign to Daniel's land, that the Western Roman Empire would not be the oppressor of Daniel's land, but of a different group of Daniel's people, the saints, the believers. They would be the ones oppressed by this terrible beast. And we're told that this beast and its horn would oppress the believers until judgment sat. In other words, until the judge, until Jesus Christ comes, the beast and the horn would be destroyed at that point, at the end, and the kingdom given to the people of the saints. That's what Daniel 7 says. We might say, well, how did that happen? How did this kingdom, representing the western leg and foot of Daniel's vision, of Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's image, how did that work? How did this beast last until the kingdom? Because for those of you who know your history, you'll know that the histories say that Rome in the West fell in 476 before the advancing Goths. How is it that this beast in Daniel 7 lasts till the kingdom? How is it that the legs and the feet last till Christ comes? Surely the western leg was terminated in 476 when the Roman Empire was conquered by the Goths. But that's not what Nebuchadnezzar saw, and it's not what Daniel saw. Nebuchadnezzar saw the iron and the leg and the foot extending all the way till the stone arrives, till the rock strikes it, until Christ returns. And then here in this vision, the beast will last until Christ comes. So how does that work? Well, even though the Roman Empire proper was captured by Odoacer, the Gothic king, around 476. That wasn't because Odoacer wanted to overthrow it. The interesting thing is, Odoacer wanted to join it. He wanted to become it. And he sent a message on his victory to the emperor in the eastern leg of Rome in Constantinople, seeking their endorsement. And it was granted. He was given the title of a patrician of the Roman Empire. And so Odoacer, the Gothic conqueror of the western part of Rome, became a patrician of the Roman Empire. And the Roman Senate supported Odoacer. And he reigned as a Roman king within a Roman kingdom until his unfortunate demise at the hands of Theodoric, who did exactly the same. He sent letters to the Roman emperor in the east, got named himself a Roman patrician, and in fact, many scholars describe Theodoric as a Roman emperor in all but name. Rome's walls were rebuilt during his reign. The Senate of Rome celebrated him by building a statue in his own. Roman law and the Roman judicial system continued on unchanged. Oh yes, the empire in the West waned and fragmented over the years, particularly as the Franks and the Lombards grew in strength, but it was still there. And there was one person who was more invested in the survival and the influence of the Roman empire in the West than others, and that was the Pope. And the Pope was working very hard throughout these years to maintain the influence of Rome. And finally, on Christmas night in 800 AD, give or take, a patron emerged who would buttress the Iron Empire and guarantee its security and its survival for the next 1,000 years, a man by the name of Charlemagne. In exchange for the title of Holy Roman Emperor and the vocal support of the Pope, Charlemagne became the guarantor of Rome's safety, and the Holy Roman Empire was born. But it wasn't a new empire. It was merely a continuation of the old. And it was an institution that would exist all the way down through time till it was snuffed out by Napoleon Bonaparte just a few short years after the French Revolution. And notice the symbology of the Holy Roman Empire. An eagle. We may have just mentioned that a little bit earlier on tonight. Moses, in his prophecy, describing the eagle. And we know that the Roman armies in the time of Christ marched under the banner of the eagle, but here it is again, and the Holy Roman Empire continues on the iconography of, well, of the Roman Empire. Go figure. And so this Iron Empire would survive until the 1800s. And then what happened? Well, at least in the West, Napoleon broke it. And following that, again and again, over the next 200 years, attempts would be made to unite, to put together again the broken pieces of the old Roman Empire in the West. So here we are, 1800, when Napoleon Bonaparte shattered what had been the Holy Roman Empire. A few years later, in 1914, a rising German republic tried to reunify the Western Roman territory under a German emperor, Wilhelm II. It's an event that triggered the Second World War, the First World War. He didn't succeed, of course. If you want more details about that, ask Rick later. He was there. But Wilhelm attempted to reunite the Roman Empire. And a few years later on, another chap by the name of Hitler attempted to do exactly the same thing, to unify the old Roman Empire within the Third Reich, a word that just means empire, the Third Empire. In fact, Hitler openly claimed that his Third Reich was the true successor to the Holy Roman Empire. He claimed that the First Reich was the Holy Roman Empire. The Second Reich was the German Empire under Wilhelm I and II and Friedrich and so on. And the Nazi Empire that occupied Europe, well, that was part of this unbroken 1,000-year history of the Holy Roman Empire. That's what Hitler claimed. Because they were trying to put together a broken kingdom, a kingdom that had now fractured into pieces, was divided. And the iconography stayed the same, didn't it? It didn't change. And these men failed in their attempts. In 1950, the French foreign minister, a man by the name of Robert Schuman, and as it happens, even though he's a French foreign minister, a German by birth, proposed a new plan. He wanted to unite the economic strength of the countries of Europe. And so in April 1951, a treaty was signed, and so commenced the European Union. But back then it had a different name. It was called the European Coal and Steel Community. Now, I know that's not quite iron and clay, but you've got to admit it's not far off, is it? Coal and steel. An iron alloy and an earthy stone, a unification of the old Western Roman Empire, an alliance of sorts, but no longer strong as it had been throughout the eras of the Holy Roman Empire. Now it was uneasy and brittle, a community of countries whose rulers are weak and malleable like soft clay, but bound together by the remnants of Rome and by a shared European Roman tradition. Indeed, its founder saw it as exactly this. In fact, all of the men involved in this project, involved in the European project to a man, were Catholic. And they saw their role in unifying Europe as a Catholic duty. Pope Paul wrote in 1977 at the opening of the Palace of Europe, he said, following on a past of wars and destruction, the common values arising from the vitality of ancient and varying peoples refined by the Greco-Roman heritage, made pure and deeper and universal by Christian, by which he means Catholic faith, have received on the plane of juridical principles renewed and effective expression in this wonderful thing that we're doing here in Europe. Now, of course, he's used a whole lot of words there that don't make any sense at all when you put them together, but the ones we're interested in is he saw common values in their Catholic faith and in their Greco-Roman heritage. He saw what this project was all about. It was about the continuation of the Roman Empire. A book written by ecumenical Christians but led by a Catholic council said this in 2005, the fact that the European Union is spiritually and culturally, for an important part of its history, the inheritor of Christianity does not confer any privilege on those citizens who consider themselves Christian, but it does not take away also any right they have to participate in the construction of the future of Europe. And they're saying, look, your Christianity, your Catholicism means that you should build a united Europe. You should continue the history of the iron in Rome, in the Roman Empire in Europe. So what happens? How does Daniel's image finish up? Well, we know, don't we? Stone comes out of a mountain, we presume, where else do stones come from? But it's cut without hands, like the one that the builders rejected. Perhaps it's curved, shaped by a river, like a pebble thrown so many years before at a giant. Very similar picture indeed. And that stone will hit the image on its feet first. And we said, well, it's wet clay and iron. Surely it'll just sort of move. But you see, that's the one place where the word is different. The toes and the feet, part of iron and part of clay. The kingdom is partly strong, but it's also brittle. The clay is bound in by the iron, and it started off soft and malleable, but in this verse here, it's described as brittle. And you think, well, okay, maybe it got old, but where is that in that verse? But you see, in the King James, that verse is kind of missing a word. There's a word that should be in there. Here it is in the New English Translation. In that the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay in the latter stages of the kingdom. The very end, they will go from being soft and malleable to brittle. At the end, it will be easily smashed. And so we come to talk briefly before we conclude about the toes. And we really haven't talked about these yet, have we? And that's for a reason. I didn't want us to get lost in the detail, trying to identify which nations, which toes represented. Oh, the big toe's got to be Germany. I didn't want us to do that. But given that the legs of iron lasted until just after the French Revolution, it follows that the toes, as a division of this image empire, won't be known until after the French Revolution. And yes, you can look at the beast of Daniel 7 and the beast of Daniel 12 and 13 and say, well, they have 10 horns representing 10 kingdoms united within the beast. But that's not what Daniel 2 is talking about, because Daniel 2 is describing for us an image at the end, just before Christ comes. And the period of the feet of Daniel's image had not yet begun when these symbols in Revelation and later in Daniel were introduced. But here's what Daniel does say. Daniel 2:44. In the days of these kings, or better, those kings. You think, well, which kings? There's only one king mentioned in the whole section there. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of kings. Which kings, plural, is he talking about? Well, he's talking about the toes. I don't know if you notice that. And the kings, right at the end of time, just before the God of heaven sets up his kingdom, just before, there will be kings, plural. So what? Those kings. He's talking about the kingdoms represented by the toes, the kingdoms united by the feet. Well, let's go to one other passage. We haven't turned away from Daniel, so just before we wrap up, let's go to Revelation 17. Revelation 17. Now, Revelation 17 is very interesting in relation to what we're talking about. It discusses the harlot who sits upon the beast and the way she leads the nations of the world to war. But we're told that the beast at that point in time, just before Christ's victory, should I say, has 10 horns. Verse 12. The beast, it says, and the 10 horns which you saw on the beast are 10 kings. Those kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, they receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast, the short toes. And they will have one mind. They'll be united as the men in the time of the Tower of Babel were. And they will give their power and their strength unto the beast. They shall make war with the Lamb. You see, these toes, these kings will become kings, will receive power as kings just before the Lamb is there to do battle with. But the Lamb will overcome them, for he's the Lord of lords and the King of kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. At the end, there will be 10 kings, there will be 10 toes. We don't know who they are yet. Well, we might be able to make an educated guess. We're not told, but they'll be there. And when they arrive and emerge, and that image finally stands up as one great Colossus, the stone will be there too at that point in time to smite them on their feet and bring that image down. I'm sure you noticed that in Daniel, that when the stone struck the image, it struck the feet first. It broke the fragile pottery and iron feet to pieces. And then, after the image had fallen, it's then that it grinds it to pieces to make room for the kingdom of God and for his son. And at least initially, we know where that will be done. That will happen on the mountains of Israel, as so many other passages have told us. Which brings us back to where we began, doesn't it? Over 150 years ago, Christadelphians were lucky enough to have people who had read the Bible and were able to interpret for us some of the things it said. The Russian autocracy. It is the Russians that will unify this kingdom. And they will be, their unified kingdom will be an excellent fulfillment of the image of Nebuchadnezzar when it stands upon the mountains of Israel, ready to be smitten by the stone. When Russia makes its grand move for the building up of its image empire, then let the reader and tonight the listener know that the end of all things as at present constituted is at hand. There's exciting things happening out there in the world. I'm sure we're all thinking about them and hearing of them at the moment. You will have known or heard that just in the last few days, Israel bombed a Russian base, perhaps poking the Russian bear just in the way that is needed. And it won't be long now, one way or another, before we start seeing that image properly standing up and moving to stand in the mountains of Israel, ready to be struck on the feet. The long-expected but stealthy advent of the King of Israel is on the eve of becoming a fact, brothers and sisters and young people. And of course, we know that salvation will be for those who are looking for it. Got to keep reading, praying, listening, and studying our Bibles. And above all, we've got to keep being excited by the Word of God, even the bits we've read 100 times before.